This is Audible.
Opening credits. Delay, Don't Deny, Living an Intermittent Fasting Lifestyle, written by Jen Stevens, narrated by the author. Foreword by Dr. Kenneth Power. Are you there, Hippocrates? It's me, Ken. Remember that oath I took on the day I earned my MD? Well, 20 years later, it seems I may not have been quite as faithful as I once promised. You remember how I vowed to do no harm and to prevent disease whenever I can, for prevention is preferable to cure? I've always had the best intentions. I didn't purposely mislead my patients when I lectured them about their eating. I just didn't know better. It was once a secret that we physicians are not trained in nutrition. We are experts in pathology and pharmacology. Yet I am asked many times each day how to fix obesity. But I'm doing better. I'm slowly making up for the years of lecturing my patients that they should eat 3 well-balanced meals each day with a few low-fat snacks thrown in between, you know, to keep the metabolism revved up. Then I was getting closer when I advocated a lower-carb, higher-fat diet for helping diabetes, but not everyone is a diabetic. Measuring early morning insulin levels on my difficult patients got me closer still, but as far as what or when to eat, I seem to be getting mixed results at best. Despite endless advice on different diets, it seemed like eventually doctors simply end up prescribing medications for cholesterol and high blood pressure. So are we any better off with this professional advice? Our country is plagued with record high levels of obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, arthritis, inflammatory diseases, irritable bowel, fibromyalgia, mood disorders, and attention deficit disorders. It feels like this is a new normal. Every day there's another new pharmaceutical commercial. This can't be right. What is going on here? This book tells it like it is. The problem for millions of people can be blamed on a society that has been transformed. We are living in an obesogenic environment. Your chance of staying fit and healthy without a clear strategy is near zero. Why do you think every casino has an all-you-can-eat buffet? Think about it. Your body is a machine controlled by a series of hormones that control your appetite and your self-control. Do you need to eat 6 times a day to thrive? Do you need diet soft drinks to be happy? Really? Who's in control here? Who's been programming these feelings and emotions? Feeding your body, your machine, is a game of big business. Treating the diseases associated with your obese body, your broken machine, is also big business. Information on nutrition has to be disseminated, read, paid, by someone, right? Take every study you read on Facebook with a major grain of salt. Come to think of it, after reading this book, you'll know you can stop worrying about salt too. Keep an open mind with this. There is some very powerful knowledge in here, but it goes against the grain, against the norm, against what is commonly believed. Remember that. Jen Stevens has knocked one out of the park with Delay, Don't Deny. As you read this several times, you'll find yourself getting lost in a conversation you're having with Jen. She's fun and easy to talk to, but she dishes out some tough love as well. There's no quick gimmick in here, but a promise of better health awaits those who follow through. My single hope is that you take your time and truly appreciate the science she covers here. Intermittent fasting is the real deal. It has dozens of well-funded, well-executed scientific studies. The protocols she describes are safe, effective, and scientifically valid. Just ask any of the thousands of followers on her Facebook support groups. Hint, search the book title on Facebook. Do it now. Best of all, she is describing a way out of the game forever. It's getting old and you are not getting any younger. This truly is a way to change your lifestyle so your body's health improves each day, month after month, less body fat, improved metabolism, reduced dependence on medications, improved blood pressure, normalization of blood sugar, not to mention improved mental clarity, self-discipline, and self-confidence. Have I mentioned that fasting has anti-aging benefits and probably improves your life expectancy? Not bad, huh? The world's a different place than when the first Hippocratic Oath was written, 400 BC. Heck, the information in this book wasn't widely known 10 years ago. It truly is an exciting time for us scientists who seek better health through nutrition. You will soon become your own experiment of one, and you have an entire legion of like-minded pioneers supporting you. Congratulate yourself on becoming part of a real movement. So I'll try a little harder to adhere to my promises over the next 20 years. No more canned responses when my next patient comes up to me desperate for answers on how to lose weight. I'll just have them enjoy a conversation with Jen and then support them on their lifetime journey of experimenting and researching the various intermittent fasting options that work for them. Kenneth Power, MD, December 2016. Disclaimer. This book is not a substitute for medical advice. All information and tools presented within this text are intended for motivational purposes. Any health, diet, or exercise advice shared here is not intended as medical diagnosis or treatment. If you think you have any type of medical condition, you must seek professional advice, even if you believe it may be due to diet, food, or exercise. You should always consult a qualified practitioner before using any dietary, exercise, or health advice from this text. Introduction. About me and what to expect from this book. Okay, you caught me. I am not a medical doctor, and I am not a nutritionist. You may be asking yourself why you should listen to a regular person like me when it comes to dietary advice. Of course, you should not take medical advice from random people that you don't know, and that includes me. Always check with your favorite trusted medical professionals when making decisions that could affect your health. If you have a medical condition, you absolutely have to talk to your physician before changing your lifestyle. Nothing in this book should be considered by you to be medical advice from me. Go listen to the disclaimer if you haven't listened to it already. Now that I've gotten that out of the way, I want to tell you a little bit about who I am. I am a 47-year-old mother of two teenage sons. I have been married to my patient husband for over 25 years, and, as I mentioned in the dedication, he has literally loved me through thick and thin. Some years were thicker than others. Like many of you, I have struggled with my weight for years, decades even, and I have tried so many different ways to lose weight. If you want to hear my whole convoluted story, go right to Appendix A for my dieting and weight loss story. I've laid it out there for you, and you may have a diet history just as crazy as mine. No, I am not a medical doctor. I do, however, have a doctorate in gifted and talented education, and I was at one time a member of Mensa. I'm actually a Mensa dropout. Oops. I don't tell you this to brag about how smart I am, but to let you know that I am able to at least get a paper successfully past a dissertation committee and pass an intelligence test. Hopefully that will give me some credibility. If that doesn't, maybe the fact that I have lost 80-plus pounds and kept it off for 2 years now, as of early 2017, should do it. If it makes you feel better, you can call me Dr. Stevens. My elementary gifted students call me that all day, and I will definitely answer to it. Or you can just call me Jen, and I will be your Jenspiration throughout this book. Think of me as a trusted friend, and imagine that we are having a casual conversation about how you can approach the business of weight loss and eventual weight maintenance. The goal of this book is to share some of the latest thinking about the weight loss strategy known as intermittent fasting. I will tell you my story and point you towards some fantastic books that were written by researchers and medical doctors. You do not have to take it from me. After hearing my story, you can go straight to the books written by the actual medical professionals and read what they have to say. You'll find an annotated bibliography of resources in Appendix C. I want to warn you right up front. The style of this book is going to be casual. I'm going to refer to sources, but not in a formal way. Many of the books I will point you to in the annotated bibliography do have comprehensive reference lists, and if you love to read scientific papers, you will find complete lists of suggested scientific sources in those reference sections. Throughout this book, I will be paraphrasing and summarizing information based on my understanding of the issues, but to gain a deeper understanding, I highly suggest that you dig deeper using the resources I recommend. I will mention some scientific thinking, but I am not going to be overly sciencey, and I might even make up some words, as I just did there with sciencey. Ready to get started? Keep listening. Chapter 1. All of the diets work, and none of them work. Diets. Even the word sounds restrictive. How many times have you read a new diet book, and when you started, you were full of enthusiasm for the plan? Wow, everything makes so much sense. The science seems to be there. You can literally eat whatever you want, and the pounds will fall right off. Then you read a little more of the book. It's not really whatever you want. You have to limit carbs, or meat, or fat, or sugar, or things that start with the letter S. That's a real book, people. But it is okay because there are so many wonderful things that you can eat that you're not even going to miss. Carbs, meat, fat, sugar, S-words. Trust me, life is delicious and satisfying, and you won't miss it at all. That is the biggest lie ever, by the way. After the first week or two, you will miss carbs, meat, fat, sugar, S-words so much that you dive headfirst into a vat of the forbidden foods, and there's the end of that diet. Again. Oops. Even though my degree is not in nutrition or medicine, over the years I have read everything about weight loss that I could get my hands on. Each time I read a new weight loss book, I would try the plan out and see if it worked for me. Unless I knew within the first few pages that it was going to be too hard because of my inherent laziness, in which case I would just stop reading and chalk that book purchase up as another mistake. Amazon loves me. I have read many excellent books and also some that are worthless. And I probably have read more about nutrition than many physicians. Do you know what is funny, though? So much of what I have read was written by doctors. And each of the books directly contradicts at least one of the other books. You know I am right. It is incredibly frustrating to see how much contradictory information is out there. Many of the diet books promoted plans that were overly complicated, and I just couldn't keep up with the rigorous demands and rules. Have you tried the one where you pack up your food in dozens of tiny containers so you can snack on them all day long just to keep your metabolism stoked? Me too. Who has time to prep all that food? I certainly do not. How about the diet books where you don't eat any carbs ever? Of course, I am again talking about food that you have to spend the weekend cooking and packing up because the food you can find in the real world doesn't meet your stringent carb count criteria. I've done that, and it wore me out. What about the plan where you only eat clean foods and follow certain rules about what is allowed? I'm sorry, was that carrot organically farmed by Tibetan monks? If not, then I will not be eating it. Thank you very much. The problem with all of these special food plans is that I don't have time or the willpower to keep up any kind of rigorous schedule where I have to work hard to always have a certain kind of food with me or to have certain foods that are eternally off limits. Like you, some days I have to work until 6 p.m., and then I may want to eat dinner that I can pick up on the way home. There is no drive-through that dispenses fancy meals that meet all of the dietary restrictions that go with each wacky diet I tried. So eventually, each plan was destined to failure for me. What about the magical supplements that you can buy that will magically allow you to magically lose the fat from your trouble areas? Magically. Been there, bought those. I used to watch Dr. Oz every day, and I would be glued to the latest weight loss miracle segment every time, knowing that, yes, this is my problem. I am deficient in this herb that is grown in the Amazonian rainforest, and once I start taking this miracle cure, I will be thin. The fat will melt off of my body. I would order each miracle supplement and then start the regimen that would allow me to effortlessly drop the fat. Usually, you had to take 3 capsules of this amazing herb 20 minutes before each meal, and then eat whatever you want and watch the pounds melt off. Again, compliance was a problem for me. I would forget to take the capsules, or I wouldn't have them with me, and eventually I would just stop taking them and add them to the drawer of failed miracle supplements. Thank the Lord I finally came to my senses and stopped DVRing Dr. Oz. These days, I don't even look directly at magazine covers if he is on them. Dr. Oz, you cost me a fortune. This is why all diets work and no diets work. We can follow a crazy restrictive regimen for a while, and we may even lose some weight. But eventually, you are going to want to eat pizza or cake or Thanksgiving dinner. These diet plans are just not sustainable long term. The good news is that with intermittent fasting, you don't have to follow a crazy diet. You can eat the foods you want to eat, and you can lose the guilt. After years of struggling and learning that I am not going to follow a traditional diet or keep up a difficult schedule of supplementation, I finally feel a confident sense of peace that I have found the key to permanent weight loss. Over a 10-month period, I lost 75 pounds, which has turned into 80-plus. Yes, I continue to lose fat slowly while in maintenance, using techniques that fit in nicely with my overall eating preferences. The best news is that my new eating style doesn't require me to make elaborate plans about what I will be eating And there's actually a wealth of cutting-edge research that shows that my new eating style is healthier than traditional diets. I am thrilled to report that I have been maintaining this weight loss for about 2 years now, and in fact, I have gotten even leaner over the past year without even trying. This is almost unheard of in today's world, where statistics show that the vast majority of people who lose weight gain it all back. I have seen estimates that only about 5% of people are able to keep off the weight long term. That sure is depressing, isn't it? So, if you are sick of trying to find the perfect diet for you and instead want to find a lifestyle that you can tailor to suit your eating preferences, you are in the right place. Intermittent fasting is not only free, but it allows you to eat whatever you want. The solution is literally in the title of this book. You will learn to delay eating rather than to deny yourself. Chapter 2, The Obesity Epidemic. Why are we so fat? It's very simple in theory. At any given moment, you can either be burning fuel from the last meal you ate, or you can be burning stored fat from your body. When you reach a point of balance where the amount of food you eat in a day perfectly matches the amount of fuel your body needs to burn in a day, you have weight maintenance. If you are eating more than your body can burn, you have fat gain. If you burn more than you store, you have fat loss. Clearly, that is the goal for anyone who is attempting to lose weight. You want to burn more fat than your body can store. How to actually do that is the big question that haunted me for years. You can probably relate. If it was easy to figure out, we would all be slim. Looks around. Nope, we're not all slim yet. In fact, data shows that Americans are getting bigger and bigger over time. Why can't we figure this out, if it is as simple as just eating less food? There are many answers to this question, depending upon who you ask. If you ask almost anyone you meet, the answer would be that we eat too much and don't move enough. That's the conventional eat less, move more strategy. Sounds so simple, doesn't it? All we have to do is eat less and move more, and we will be thin and healthy. We have all heard this advice and tried to follow it, and it is not quite so simple in practice. Why is that? Well then, it must be because we lack self-control. We all want to eat less and move more, which we have heard is the only way to lose weight. So, if we are unsuccessful, it must be because we are spineless and gluttons and weak human beings. Good news, you are not a spineless glutton. I don't even know you, and I know that to be true. There's a lot going on in your body that is out of your control. If you try to eat less over a long period of time, then certain hunger hormones are activated that make you want to eat and eat and eat. It's because your body loves you and doesn't want you to starve to death. Your body doesn't know that you're purposefully restricting your food intake, and it thinks you must be in some sort of terrible famine. The hunger hormones cause you to seek out whatever food you can find, and that's when you end up standing at the refrigerator door eating anything you can shove into your mouth. Been there, done that. That's the moment when you feel like a weak failure with no self-control. When you realize why you feel that way, because it is your body trying to keep you alive, you can cut yourself some slack. Others would say that we are fat because portions are bigger. Well, I'm pretty sure that we do expect bigger portions these days, whether we are eating at home or at a restaurant. All I have to do is think about my grandmother's generation and how they ate. When she died, I inherited her fine china. You should see how small the serving bowls and serving platters are. The serving bowls are not much bigger than the cereal bowls you can buy now at most stores. And the set has tiny little coffee cups and saucers. There were no giant coffee mugs or huge travel tumblers back then for us to fill with creamy coffee goodness and drink on the go. No, they would sit and drink their tiny little cups of coffee and then be done with it. The set also comes with a little cream and sugar service, and the cream pitcher holds less cream than I would use for one cup of coffee. So there is an element of truth in the idea of bigger portions. Maybe if we had never started eating huge meals, we wouldn't see such an obesity epidemic. I have a feeling, though, that big portions are here to stay. I have also heard people blame the fact that we eat out more. Just look at the number of restaurants all around us, particularly fast food restaurants. Not only are there more and more restaurant options to choose from, but we are busy. Many families have either one single working parent or two parents who are both working. When you are working all day long, it can be hard to find the energy to come home and put a balanced meal on the table. It is so much easier to pick up something on the way home or rely on packaged foods from the supermarket. Unfortunately, many things we can pick up or prepare in a hurry are devoid of nutrients and not the highest quality. One other thought is that our food supply is different now. In some areas, the soil has been depleted of nutrients due to years of farming, and we are genetically modifying many of our crops. We add corn syrup to almost everything, and there are artificial flavors, colors, sweeteners, and preservatives in many store-bought foods. Grocery store food is certainly different than what our great-grandparents ate. One popular diet book tells us that even wheat available today is different than it used to be. So why does all of this matter? I've read the theory that our bodies don't recognize these artificially grown and developed items as food. Doritos, though delicious, are not picked from a Dorito bush. Because of that, our bodies are always in search of nutrients, which makes us hungrier. We eat and eat, yet never feel satisfied. So, our portions are bigger, we eat out more, we reach for convenience foods, and our food supply has changed. Our hunger hormones are on overdrive because we have tried unsuccessfully to restrict what we are eating, and we are eating processed junk. I do think that all of these factors work together to make it harder for us to lose weight. However, I think there is an even bigger culprit, and this is the piece of the puzzle I was always missing when I tried to change what I was eating. The problem is meal frequency. We are constantly in a fed state and never get a chance to access our stored fat. By changing when I was eating, I was able to lose weight while worrying less about what I was eating. Why are we constantly in a fed state? Think about it for a minute. What is the latest dietary advice? If you said, eat frequent and small meals throughout the day to fuel your metabolism, then you are right on target. This very advice is why we are having so much trouble losing weight. Are there people who can eat frequent small meals during the day and lose weight? Of course there are. I am not one of them, however, and if you have struggled with your weight, you probably aren't one of them either. In this book, you will learn how to finally enter a fat-burning state every day of your life so that you can access the fat you have stored on your body. The best news of all, you can do it eating the foods you love. Again, remember the name of the book, Delay, Don't Deny. Chapter 3, The Problem with Calories. As I mentioned in the beginning of the book, I am going to summarize what I have learned about how the body works. Remember that I am not a medical doctor or a nutritionist, and keep that in mind as you read. Also, remember that nothing I am discussing should be considered to be specific medical advice from me to you. There are fantastic books written by actual medical doctors and experts in the field. See the annotated bibliography located in Appendix C for my recommendations that you can and should refer to in order to learn more about these topics. I am going to hit the highlights so that you have a basic understanding of what is going on in our bodies. Perhaps my analogies or explanations will be oversimplified in places. Remember, I'm an elementary teacher, so I spend my whole day simplifying complex things so that young kids will understand them. Now for some science. Conventional diet advice tells you that you have to restrict calories to lose weight. Everyone knows this. As I mentioned in the last chapter, it is simple. You must burn more energy than you take in if you want to lose weight. Scientists have figured out a way to measure the amount of energy in various foods in a lab, and they call the energy calories. Back in the day, our great-grandparents didn't know what calories were. Somehow, they were able to eat appropriate amounts of food, and it was rare to see an obese person back then. How did they do it without counting calories when they didn't even know what calories were? By now, though, we've all heard of calories, and most of us have tried to count them at one time or another. Scientists have shown that the calorie calculations of various foods are consistent over time, in a lab. Unfortunately, or fortunately, your body is not a lab. Think about it. Do you really believe that you could eat 1,200 calories of jelly beans and have the same outcome as if you eat 1,200 calories of raw vegetables? Spoiler alert, you can't, at least not long term. The theory that our bodies work like a calorie calculator can be called calories in, calories out. My favorite weight loss expert, Dr. Jason Fung, has named it the calorie restriction as primary theory, CRAP, which he refers to as the crap theory. This makes me giggle every time I read it. I have included his favorite book, The Obesity Code, in the annotated bibliography located in Appendix C. He also has a blog at the Intensive Dietary Management website, and I highly recommend it. I have learned a lot from his book and blog. Another fantastic book that debunks the calories in, calories out theory is Good Calories, Bad Calories by Gary Taub. So, why is calories in, calories out crap when the theory sounds so good and is so widely circulated as the only way to lose weight effectively? It's because it doesn't work for us long term. You may have tried a calorie counting diet before. You started counting your calories diligently, you stuck to your plan, and yes, you were rewarded with weight loss. Week after week, your weight went down until you reached your goal weight. Once you got to your goal weight, you were able to effortlessly maintain your ideal weight by continuing to count calories, and the end, you lived happily ever after in your goal wardrobe. Is that how it worked for you? No? Me neither. Why is that? Let's take a lesson from the hit television show, The Biggest Loser. In this reality show, the contestants lose truly amazing amounts of weight each week by following the magic formula of calories in, calories out. They reduce their calories in dramatically and amp up their calories out through so much physical exertion that they often become physically ill right on television. Now, that's entertainment. For the final episode of the year, the contestants return to reveal their final transformations. These are truly inspiring stories of people who have worked harder than they have ever worked in their lives to conquer the obesity demons that they have struggled with for so long. They look fantastic, and the audience is inspired. Let me share their dirty little secret with you. Their long-term results are abysmal, horrific, shocking. The contestants have very little long-term success, and notice that they never had a reunion show where everyone is slim and fit. The next time you are near a computer, do a search for a study called Persistent Metabolic Adaptation 6 Years After the Biggest Loser Competition. The title of the study tells it all. The contestants featured in the show suffered from something called persistent metabolic adaptation after their amazing transformations. This means that their metabolisms had slowed down more than would be expected. This study showed that the period of prolonged calorie restriction, their calories in, calories out marathon, had an adverse effect that cost the participants 500 calories per day. They had to eat 500 fewer calories for their new weights than calculations based on body size alone would predict, just to maintain their new weights. Here's an example of what that would look like in the real world. If we perform standard metabolic calculations on a hypothetical 5'5", 40-year-old woman who weighs 125 pounds and is moderately active, the calculator tells us that she is supposed to burn about 2,036 calories per day, based on size and activity level. What the Biggest Loser study found is that instead of burning the expected number of calories, the participants' average metabolic rate was decreased by approximately 500 calories. In our hypothetical example, that would be a metabolic rate of 1,536 calories to maintain her weight instead of the expected 2,036. Before the show, these contestants had normal metabolic rates as calculated for their sizes. As they lost weight, their bodies slowed their metabolisms to compensate. But after the show, their metabolisms never recovered. They never again burned the expected number of calories for their size. Dr. Fung does a phenomenal job explaining why this happens in his blog at Intensive Dietary Management. I encourage you to go there and read it. To simplify it for you here, all you need to really know is that the body did just what it was designed to do. Metabolic rate slowed down to protect the contestants. When the body perceives prolonged calorie restriction, it will slow down your metabolism as a protective measure. Research shows this clearly, as illustrated in the Biggest Loser study. So, are we doomed for failure? I know that was the tone of all of the news reports that came out after this study was released. And if counting calories was the only tool we had for weight loss, then I would agree. Why bother if we are doomed to a life of constant deprivation? Fortunately, as I said, the body is not a calorie calculator. Instead, the body works based on hormonal signals and responses that happen behind the scenes. Instead of worrying about how many calories you are eating, what you really need to worry about is how much insulin your body is releasing during the day. In the next chapter, you'll learn about why that is so important. Chapter 4, Insulin, the key to unlocking your fat stores. What is insulin and why is it important? You may only know of insulin as something prescribed to diabetics, and you may give little thought to how it works in a normal body. To oversimplify for the sake of basic understanding, every time you eat or drink certain things, your body releases insulin in response, unless you are a type 1 diabetic. Insulin's job is to help your body regulate your blood glucose. When you eat, your blood sugar is available to be either burned as energy or stored in the body as glycogen. Think of it as quick energy for later that is easily accessible. Any that is not burned as energy or stored as glycogen will be turned into fat. Insulin is the conductor of the blood sugar train. We need insulin for this process to occur. This is why type 1 diabetics rely on insulin injections that they must carefully adjust to match everything they consume. Without insulin, they are unable to properly utilize their blood glucose, which leads to dramatic weight loss. In 150 AD, a Greek physician described the condition as the melting down of flesh and limbs into urine. The early tests for diabetes involved tasting the urine, and the unlucky physician was rewarded by a taste of sweetly flavored urine. I know modern doctors are happy that we have new diagnostic techniques. Without insulin, no matter how much diabetics eat, they continue to lose weight to an unhealthy degree. There goes the calories in, calories out theory. It's not a lack of calories that are causing them to lose weight. It's a lack of insulin. Insulin also holds the key to the fat that is already in your fat cells. When you have a lot of insulin circulating throughout your body is not going to be able to easily access your stored fat. It's a fat-storing hormone, after all. If you remember this piece of the puzzle, you are on your way to solving your fat-burning problem. Lots of circulating insulin equals efficient fat storage and very little fat burning. One other problem with high insulin levels is that our bodies adjust over time to elevated levels of insulin, which leads to more insulin being released, which leads to even higher levels of circulating insulin. This is known as insulin resistance. When you develop insulin resistance, your body has to release more and more insulin just to do the job because, in theory, your body has stopped listening to the normal amount of insulin. It's like a class of kids with a teacher who yells at them all of the time. Eventually, the kids stop listening and they tune out the yelling. So the teacher yells more. It's a vicious cycle. The kids have developed yelling resistance, so the teacher has to yell more frequently to try to get their attention. Remember, the more insulin you have circulating, the easier it is for you to store fat, and the harder it is for you to access stored fat. Your body becomes very efficient at stuffing all of your fat cells full of energy and isn't accessing any of your stored fat for energy. This leads to excessive hunger because the foods you eat get stored away as fat so readily. Thanks, insulin. So now you're eating more, storing it away efficiently as fat, and you're constantly ravenous. There is a lot of complexity to the process, and rather than try to explain all of it and risk making huge errors, I'm going to refer you to the excellent explanations written in the various books listed in Appendix C. Dr. Fung explains it beautifully in The Obesity Code. There are also other hormones that have roles in the process, such as leptin and ghrelin. I'll mention those appetite control hormones in a bit more depth later. If you love science and want to understand more about what is happening with all of these hormones, please take some time to research and learn more. It's fascinating stuff. And it makes you wonder why anyone can believe in straight up calories in, calories out anymore. I may have just oversimplified the complex processes at play, but what you need to take away from this chapter is this. By focusing on calories, many of us have missed one of the main drivers of the obesity crisis, and that is insulin. In order to lose weight successfully, you need to figure out how to lower your insulin levels so that your body can access your stored fat effectively. Rather than counting calories and tanking our metabolisms, as we saw with The Biggest Losers, we need to access our stored fat and keep our metabolisms working at high speed so that we can maintain our weight loss permanently. So, how do we do that? Intermittent fasting. Chapter 5. What is intermittent fasting and why should we do it? There are only two states your body can be in at one time, fed or fasted. In fact, you are in one of those states right now. Even if you are a typical American who eats breakfast, lunch, and dinner with snacks in between because we have been told that the more meals we eat, the faster our metabolisms will run, you wake up each morning in a fasted state. The first meal of the day is called break fast because it's then that you break the nightly fast. So, congratulations! You are already fasting every single day of your life. Fasting doesn't sound quite so odd when you think of it that way, does it? You're already a faster and you didn't even know it. So now that we have determined that you already fast every single day, it's just a matter of extending the fast. Unless you wake up at night to eat every few hours, in which case you are eating like a newborn who specifically eats that way to gain body size. Think about it. I'm pretty sure that you don't wake up at night to eat, so we have confirmed that your body already knows how to fast. But why should we fast? Ah, that's the best part. Fasting gives us a metabolic advantage that other weight loss programs are missing. Remember from the calories chapter? When our bodies perceive that we are in a caloric deficit, our metabolisms slow to protect us. We saw that in the Biggest Loser study. The key to making any weight loss plan work for us is in keeping our bodies from perceiving that we are in a caloric deficit. That is where the magic of fasting comes in. When your body becomes adapted to fasting and you don't spike insulin during the fast, more about how to do that in the Keeping the Fast chapter, you become a fat-burning machine during the fast. Your body finally taps into your fat stores, and the energy you have stored on your body can power you throughout the day. That is what it is stored there for, after all. Here is how the magic happens. Because you have plenty of stored energy right there on your body, and you can finally access it efficiently, your body does not get the signal that you are in an energy deficit. This is big news, people. Your metabolism does not slow, as the Biggest Loser's metabolisms slowed. Find a computer and search for a study called Resting Energy Expenditure in Short-Term Starvation is Increased as a Result of Increase in Serum Norepinephrine. That's a mouthful, but it's pretty exciting when you understand what Resting Energy Expenditure means. So what is Resting Energy Expenditure? It's how much energy your body burns while at rest. Don't let the word starvation scare you, though. When you are fasting, you aren't in danger of starvation. With an intermittent fasting schedule, you're only fasting intermittently. It's in the name of it, after all. In the conclusion of that study, the authors state, resting energy expenditure increases in early starvation, accompanied by an increase in plasma norepinephrine. This increase in norepinephrine seems to be due to a decline in serum glucose and may be the initial signal for metabolic changes in early starvation. Because of the fasting, resting energy expenditure went up rather than down. Besides increasing resting energy expenditure, intermittent fasting has other health benefits which are being explored by the medical research community. To find an article that summarizes some of the research, do a computer search using this title, Fasting: Molecular Mechanisms and Clinical Applications. I highly recommend that you read this article for yourself. It was released in 2014 and summarizes some of the benefits of various fasting protocols. It's exciting stuff. From the article, quote, as detailed in the remainder of this article, findings from well-controlled investigations in experimental animals and emerging findings from human studies indicate that different forms of fasting may provide effective strategies to reduce weight, delay aging, and optimize health, unquote. The authors go on to provide specific benefits from various research studies. The research they summarize has shown that fasting increases cognitive function, is anti-aging, may protect against cancer and various neurological diseases, and reduces inflammation. Yes, this is an exciting time for research related to intermittent fasting. In fact, the 2016 Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Yoshinori Osumi for his research related to a process called autophagy. What is autophagy? It's a process that occurs naturally within your own body. It's how your body breaks down excess cellular junk. As an oversimplification, think of it as your body's own recycling system, and it's how your cells take out the garbage. Why do we need autophagy to happen? Overaccumulation of cellular garbage is responsible for various diseases or conditions related to aging. If you don't give your body a chance to clean out the garbage, it gunks up the whole system. Think about how this would look in your own household. If you stopped taking out the garbage, things would get out of control very quickly. Our bodies rely on the process of autophagy to maintain our healthy state. Disrupt autophagy has been linked to Parkinson's disease, type 2 diabetes, and other disorders that appear in the elderly. Mutations in autophagy genes can cause genetic diseases. These disturbances have also been linked to cancer. Whoa. As you can see, taking out the cellular garbage is pretty important. What stimulates autophagy? If you guessed fasting, then you are correct. Autophagy has one other exciting benefit for those of us who are losing weight through intermittent fasting. Remember, during autophagy, your body is taking out the cellular garbage. As we lose weight through fasting, our bodies eat up the excess proteins hanging around in various places, and that can include excess skin. When people lose fat following a traditional low-calorie diet plan, where they don't get the benefits of autophagy, they can be left with saggy skin. You may have seen photos of people who have experienced extreme weight loss, and they are often left with so much excess skin that they need to have surgery to correct the problem. Dr. Fung, author of The Obesity Code and the Intensive Dietary Management blog, has worked with many patients in his medical practice, and he uses intermittent fasting to help them lose tremendous amounts of weight. He reports that his patients, who experience autophagy, thanks to fasting, don't have the problem of excess skin, even after losing in excess of 100 pounds. How exciting is that? So, in this chapter, we have learned that we already fast every day. Short-term fasting has been shown to rev up our metabolisms, and research on fasting shows many amazing health benefits. Instead of worrying that fasting is extreme or dangerous, we see that it's incredibly beneficial and on the cutting edge of medical research. Now that you know why you should fast, it's time to learn how. Note, since fasting has so many health benefits, you may be wondering if there is anyone who should not adopt a fasting lifestyle. It's important to know that fasting is not appropriate for children or pregnant women or nursing mothers. Fasting is also not appropriate for anyone who has been diagnosed with an eating disorder. One important distinction between fasting and an eating disorder: fasting will not cause you to develop an eating disorder, which is a psychological condition, but if you suffer from an eating disorder, fasting can exacerbate it. In addition, if you have any health conditions, you should consult a medical professional before beginning a fasting regimen. And again, you should not take medical advice from me. You should always consult your doctor if you are in doubt. Chapter 6, Finding Your Ideal Intermittent Fasting Plan. There are many different intermittent fasting plans out there. I have included summaries of the books I have found to be most helpful in the annotated bibliography section of this book, and you can go to that section to hear about each one of them. Once you decide which intermittent fasting plan you want to try, I highly recommend that you research the plan for yourself by reading the original plan as written by its author. I have great respect for these authors, and each book on the list has shaped my thinking about intermittent fasting and why it is effective. Personally, I have tried every type of intermittent fasting plan available. In fact, I started dabbling in intermittent fasting in about 2009. I never viewed it as a lifestyle, however, so I would try a plan briefly and then fall off of the wagon. If you hear my story in Appendix A, I have outlined it all there for you, the whole messy story. Instinctually, I knew that intermittent fasting would be the answer for me as soon as I heard about it, but I never would commit or follow through until I hit rock bottom in 2014. Once I realized that I no longer wanted to ride the weight gain roller coaster, I was ready to commit. I finally understood that intermittent fasting was a lifestyle and not another diet plan, and I experimented until I found what works for me. The best part is that I have a whole toolbox full of intermittent fasting strategies that I can pull out when I need them to suit my current situation. I can pick and choose which strategies to implement based on how I want to live my life. In a nutshell, there are two main types of intermittent fasting strategies: plans you do every day, or an eating window approach, or plans you implement a certain number of times per week, which is an up and down day approach. Which approach to intermittent fasting is the best? It's the one that makes you feel in control and the one that you can follow long term as a lifestyle. That's important to understand from the beginning. Intermittent fasting is a lifestyle. It isn't something that you start today and then end when you get to some arbitrary goal weight. Something you start and then stop is a diet. Intermittent fasting isn't a diet. As I said, it's a lifestyle. Before I get into the specifics of an eating window approach versus an up and down day approach, I want to talk about hormones again. From the insulin chapter, you may recall that insulin is the key to fat storage versus fat burning. If you keep insulin as low as possible in your body, you are able to burn fat. If insulin is high, your body wants to store fat. Insulin is the key hormone to understand if you want to lose weight and keep it off long term. Insulin isn't, however, the only hormone that affects your results. There are other hormonal regulators of appetite as described in a paper which is called, surprisingly, Hormonal Regulators of Appetite. Do a search for that paper if you're interested in learning more. The paper explains in a very sciencey way how ghrelin and leptin work together to give you signals related to your food intake and how much fat you have stored on your body. To oversimplify a very complex process, ghrelin tells us that we need to eat, and leptin tells us that we have had enough. If your body is sensitive to both ghrelin and leptin, and everything is working as it should, you will remain at your ideal weight effortlessly, and your appetite will tell you when to eat and when to stop. We are born with these hormones working perfectly in concert with one another. A baby doesn't know how many calories he has had, but he gets hunger signals to let him know that it is time to eat. If you have ever tried to feed a toddler who isn't hungry, you have seen that it can be impossible. If they aren't hungry, they aren't going to eat, which is how we should all live our lives. Children come to us with appetite hormones that are working perfectly, and then we force them to eat at mealtimes on an arbitrary schedule, and then we feed them highly processed foods, both of which work together to cause our kids to completely lose sight of their satiety signals. Thanks, Mom. When we follow restrictive diets, count calories, eat according to an arbitrary meal schedule, etc., we disconnect from our satiety hormones. We eat because it is time to eat. We eat because food is available. The more we do it, the worse shape we are in. Bottom line, if you have had trouble sticking to a diet, it isn't your fault. It's your hormones. The overwhelming drive to eat is coming from ghrelin telling you to eat more. You are no longer able to get the signals from leptin telling you that you have had enough. Understand that uncontrollable or constant hunger is a sign that you have made some dietary choices that aren't working for you. On the other hand, satiety is a good sign, telling you that your body is happy with what you are doing. So why am I mentioning this here in the chapter on finding your perfect intermittent fasting plan? Stick with me. If you go to the annotated bibliography and hear my description of Dr. Herring's second book, Appetite Correction, you'll hear my explanation of the state he calls appetite correction, or AC. You really should buy his book and read what he has to say. It's worth it. What he calls appetite correction is actually a state of regulated hormones. You suddenly have leptin and ghrelin working as they should, and part of this is because you can access your fat stores appropriately due to low levels of circulating insulin. You eat according to appetite and never have to count another calorie again because you have gotten your hormones back into the state that nature intended. Hallelujah and pass the collection plate. You may not get that joke if you're not a Southerner. Remember this when you are experimenting to find your ideal intermittent fasting plan. You need to look for the one that gives you this hormonal correction Dr. Herring describes as appetite correction. It won't happen overnight, as it takes time to undo years of damage. Once you get there, though, you'll know, because you'll have a level of peace around food that you have never had in recent memory. You can pass up cake because you are full. When I stick to my preferred intermittent fasting lifestyle, I live in a state of balance where ghrelin and leptin work together to control my appetite, just as nature intended. In the next two chapters, I'll summarize both the eating window approach and the up and down day approach to help you decide which might be the best fit for your lifestyle. Then, in the next chapter, I describe my own preferred approach to intermittent fasting called the one meal a day lifestyle. Even if the name sounds overly restrictive and you are hesitant to commit to such an extreme plan, I suggest that you listen to that chapter with an open mind. I have found my own best results and the most dietary freedom with the one meal a day lifestyle. It's the plan that gets my hormones into balance the best. If you had told me that 5 years ago, I would have refused to believe it, but it is true. Chapter 7, An Eating Window Approach to Intermittent Fasting. In an eating window intermittent fasting plan, you set a specific period of time for your daily eating window, and all caloric food and beverages must be consumed within that period of time. As soon as the first bite of food or sip of caloric beverage enters your mouth, your window is open, and when you take your last bite or sip, it is closed. I have seen eating windows as short as 1 hour and windows as long as 10 to 12 hours. I would never personally consider or even recommend a 10 to 12 hour eating window. That's just not enough fasting for most people to get the results they are hoping for. An eating window somewhere between 1 to 8 hours is more typical and should give most people better results. My first foray into an eating window was the Fast 5 plan, written by Dr. Bert Herring. In Dr. Herring's plan, you have a daily 5-hour eating window. I think that a 5-hour window is a great starting point for many people, but you will need to experiment with a variety of window lengths to find what works for you. While personally experimenting with window length, I also tried an 8-hour eating window, which is one promoted by other intermittent fasters. For me, 8 hours is just too long, and I don't lose any weight following an 8-hour eating window. That doesn't mean that an 8-hour window won't be perfect for you. It just doesn't work at all for me. As I said, you should experiment to find which window length works best for you. Our bodies are all very different, and what works for me might not be the best plan for you. In the Fast 5 plan, which I suggest is a great starting point, Dr. Herring personally uses the 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. period of time for his window. He does say that you can choose whatever 5-hour window works best for you, but I think his recommendation for 5 to 10 p.m. is genius. Let me explain. When I first started, I wanted to maximize the number of eating opportunities available to me, so I used a 12:30 to 5:30 eating window. That allowed me to eat a full lunch and a full dinner every day. Sounds great, doesn't it? Well, if you are like me, you can fit a lot of food into a full lunch and a full dinner. Weight loss was very slow because I was eating a lot of food every day. When I reread Dr. Herring's book, I realized that several times throughout it, he mentioned eating one meal each day in your 5-hour window, and suddenly everything clicked into place for me. Instead of trying to maximize eating opportunities, I needed to find a window that would allow me to feel satisfied, but without two full meals every day. When I shifted my window to one that opened at 5 p.m., I had much better results. The timing of my 5-hour window made a tremendous difference in my overall success. I don't always wait until 5 p.m. every single day to open my window, but I do aim for one real meal each day within a window that is no more than 5 hours. This is what I usually do, but I'm not psycho about it. I want this to be a lifestyle that I adjust to suit me rather than something that controls my life in a rigid manner. It's fine to open my window with a snack and eat a meal later, or I might choose to open my window with a meal and then eat a snack later. Some days I eat one meal only and that's it. I listen to my body, and on days that I am hungrier, I eat more. On days when I am not as hungry, I eat less. I don't calculate calories, and I don't restrict any foods, though I do pay attention to how certain foods make me feel. Now that I pay more attention to satiety signals, thanks appetite and satiety hormones, my thoughts are no longer about how much food I can cram into a 5-hour window, which has made it work much better for me. I don't even really track my window anymore. But when I do, I find that a 2 to 3 hour window is enough for most days. If you had told me 5 years ago that I would be happily eating one real meal per day and limiting all intake to a 2 to 3 hour window most days, I would have run screaming from the idea. It sounds crazily restrictive. In actuality, I have never had the peace around food that I have now. I genuinely eat whatever I want every day until I am full and satisfied. It feels too good to be true, but it is true. One of the benefits of an intermittent fasting plan with a daily eating window is that it is easy to fall into a rhythm. Your body learns to expect food at a certain time each day, and once you adjust to that schedule, it becomes easy. In fact, I find it to be easier than eating all day long. You don't have to make any food decisions until your window opens. No constant thoughts of, should I eat this now? Because when the window is closed, it's closed. I used to have many thoughts about eating during a typical day, and now I don't. It is so much more peaceful. If you have never fasted before, that might sound unbelievable, but once you get used to it, it is such a great way to live. Notice that I mentioned in the previous paragraph how easy it is once you adjust. I'm going to be honest with you here. The adjustment period can be the hardest part of implementing an intermittent fasting regimen, and it is why many people fail. When you first start, your body is used to being in a fed state during the day. This means that your body is used to running off of your circulating blood glucose and stored glycogen for energy. As soon as you run out of ready energy, your body sends a signal for you to eat, and you fuel back up with a snack, a meal, or that afternoon latte. When you begin fasting, however, you don't give in to those signals to eat, and your body can get mad at you. The signals to eat keep coming. You might feel shaky, tired, or get a headache. You may even feel a little sick to your stomach. These feelings can be unpleasant, and if you eat, you'll feel better immediately. It's the number one reason most people give me for being unwilling to try intermittent fasting. They think they can't because they get headaches and low blood sugar. This adjustment period is a barrier for many, but I want to encourage you to commit to a week or two before you decide that you can't fast. Here's the thing you need to remember. Your goal is to start burning your own fat for fuel. The only way to tap into that stored fat is to stop running on glucose and glycogen. You can either be a fat burner or a sugar burner. The end. Making the transition from a sugar burner to a fat burner is the hard part. But once you do it, you will be amazed at how good you feel. I promise. Take today. I'm writing this at 4:45 p.m. I'm starting to get some mild hunger signals because my body anticipates that I will break my fast within the next hour or two. No, I don't start shoving food into my mouth as soon as 5 o'clock hits. Anymore, though there have been days like that. Today, I wrote for several hours, then went to visit some friends. I jumped on the trampoline with their children. While there, I refused to eat some jelly beans that I was offered. Apparently, they might be delicious or they might be booger flavored. You can't tell from looking at them. It's some sort of fun surprise in every bite. Thank goodness that fasting saved me from that fate. I ran a few errands and then came back home to more writing. I haven't felt tired or lethargic for one moment all day. Contrast that with yesterday, which just happened to be Christmas Day. Because intermittent fasting is flexible, I opened my window at noon with a Christmas brunch. I was ready for a nap by 2 p.m., and I needed a cup of coffee mid-afternoon to keep me going. Then I had to have a snack before dinner. Then dinner. Oof. I thoroughly enjoyed my time with family, but I didn't enjoy the way I felt after eating all of that food. The lesson that I want to share is this. I feel better today fasting than I did yesterday when I began eating at noon. I didn't have more energy from my frequent meals, and actually I had profoundly less energy. This is because it takes a surprising amount of energy to digest food, and I notice that whenever I open my window early in the day. I get a distinct afternoon slump. When I'm fasting, I don't get that slump, ever. In fact, one reason I gave up alternate day fasting, which I discuss in the next chapter, is that when I do a full fast over 24 hours in length, I can't sleep at night. I have so much energy that it keeps me awake. When you first start fasting, you will be stuck in that in-between transition period that I already mentioned. Your body will yell at you to eat, because it's used to running on glucose and glycogen. You are going to be grumpy, tired, hangry. Trust me, the promised land is around the corner once you make that transition to fat burning. Once you get past the transition, you'll wonder how you ever managed to eat all day long. There are several ways to make the transition easier. One idea is to gradually shorten your eating window until you find a length that works for you. Start with skipping breakfast. Gradually push back your lunchtime every day until you're breaking your fast in the late afternoon. This is a sensible approach that many people use when beginning an intermittent fasting lifestyle. Another way to make the transition easier involves a temporary change in what you are eating during the day. Notice that I said it is temporary. I don't restrict anything in my diet, and I am not going to ask you to do it either.